the most conservative talk, the least speculative, because in fact, the effective field theory is really just usual field theory with a few techniques that have been developed over the past couple of decades that allow us to extract information about different scales. So it's really not speculative at all. It's really just the applications of effective of usual field theory to usual general relativity. And I'm going to start with an introduction to help reorient your heads away from the things you normally think about to the effective field theory way of thinking about it. And then I'll actually show you effective field theory in a different context where we don't have our usual thoughts about general relativity in mind, and then turn to applying the same techniques to general relativity. Talk about the limits of the effective field theory because it is a limited theory, and then make some closing comments that you may have thought more about than I. There we go, thank you. So here's a bunch of quotes by good people in recent times about the problems of quantum gravity. Some of them, a couple of these are by people in the audience. They're pretty standard quotes. Quantum mechanics and relativity contradict each other, that the renormalizability problems of quantum gravity lead to a nonsensical theory. So they're things that you've seen before, but they're in fact incorrect. They're inaccurate now. They reflect, so I have to do this each time. I don't have control over it. It's not working. No, I want the next slide. So you have to do that each time? Okay. They reflect an out-of-date understanding of field theory. In particular, the effective field theory techniques that I'll describe have superseded those comments. And to reorient you, let's think about a truism that physics is an experimental science. We build it up piece by piece over scales and distances and energies that we can access by experiments, and that our theories are designed and constructed to be good in that domain, the region of accessible energies, and then we expect there are new degrees of freedom, new theories outside of that range. Next. This worked ahead of time. So this allows us to think about the usual questions of quantum mechanics and general relativity in a different way. We have them both over some accessible energies. Are they compatible over those energies? And the answer to that is yes, and that's what effective field theory brings to the game. It allows us to answer that question where we had trouble with it before. It basically is a technique for handling the separation of what we know from what we don't know and making predictions in the region where we know. There's another quote here that I like from Frank Wilczek that there's a perfectly well-defined quantum theory of gravity that agrees accurately with all experimental data. Well, the last half of that is Frank's sense of humor because the predictions are so small that there's no contradictions with data. But the first part of it is a meaningful statement. There's a perfectly well-defined theory of quantum theory of gravity, and that's the point here. Next one, please. Next. Okay, so here's a set of other statements that at ordinary energies and scales, so things that where they both are expected to hold, the quantum theory of general relativity exists and it has the form of an effective field theory, and the effective field theory completes the treatment that was started, the covariant treatment by Feynman and DeWitt back in the 60s. It's the missing piece that changes our focus from energies where the theory presumably falls apart to theories, energies where the theory is expected to hold. Next, please. So, I don't have to tell you that there are still issues. This is not the ultimate solution for nature. The effective field theory has its limits, and in fact points to the limits of its own validity. And there are various ways of phrasing that. Those are some attempted quotes to phrase the problems. But they're not really quantum mechanics versus general relativity per se. They're extremes of general relativity in extreme situations, or quantum mechanics in extreme situations. But I argue that this is progress, so we have a foundation to build more elaborate theories in the future. Next, please. So my use of effective field theory at the start is going to be in nucleon scattering, or chiral perturbation theory is the technical phrase. This is a huge community, thousands of papers written, many experiments done, high order calculations in field theory done. So it's one where we know what we're doing very well. It's then a nice little test case for showing you how effective field theory works. So let's think about the foundations of it for the moment. First, I'd like to make the argument that you need to do a field theory treatment here if you're going to do anything in this situation. So let's imagine nucleon scattering. Back in the days before field theory, people used causality, analyticity crossing, and to write out dispersive representations for scattering interactions. This is the scattering potential is really the low energy limit of a scattering amplitude. Okay, and this particular one here, the rho here is the imaginary part of the scattering amplitude, and V is the whole scattering amplitude. Okay, and we get the usual coordinate space one by Fourier transforming. Please, yes, thank you. Next. What goes into that spectral function, that rho, the thing that determined the dispersion relation? Well, only on-shell states. So there's nothing about unphysical states at high energies. It's only on-shell states at the energy that you're working at. So that's why people did this early on. The lightest intermediate states here are two pions. If you can look at this in this channel, those two pions go on-shell. I'm going to show you formulas and stuff in the limit that the pions are massless just to make it pretty. But you can do other things too. But there's nothing else in nature. There is nothing else in nature that's lighter than these two pions. And if pions are massless, they go down to zero energy. Okay? And so the way you build that interaction up there is you just look at Compton scattering of pions. Pion scattering, we know this happens. These are on-shell states. We tie them together. You take those matrix elements, you tie them together. You project out the S wave, because that's what I'm looking at here. And you have your answer, and the spectral function then goes like some power of the momentum transfer at low energies. That's just using these known low energy vertices. Okay, next. And here's the real world, the dashed curves. This is my non-real world with a massless pion. You get a threshold behavior that's pretty well determined. And you determine the longest distance piece of the nucleon-nucleon interaction without anything but just analyticity crossing, et cetera, and some measured numbers. So that's the precursor to effective field theory. So, next. Is there any way I could get that button up here? No? All right. This precursor reconstructs the low energy amplitudes, real parts, imaginary parts. You got the whole amplitude. Now, how do you find this result in field theory? Nowadays, we want to do field theory. How do you find it? Well, it's simple. The loop diagrams have the same crossing analyticity causality properties that were postulated there. So loops automatically generate these things. The only way that you get them is looking at these loop diagrams. And so the loop captures physics that is known to be there, and it has to be there by very general principles. So it's not that you can't do loops. However, yep. Loops, however, have the feature that if you do pi on loops, you know you're going to get something wrong. The low energy behavior is right because they're the lightest degrees of freedom, but their high energy behavior is, in fact, incorrect. At high energy, it's QCD. And so if you look at the plot, you can actually see that happening. Here's the low energy behavior pions. If you just took loops, you get a curve that goes like this. It blows up. It's divergent, actually. Badly divergent. And the real interaction turns over. And yeah, you could do, by doing two loops, you can get a little bit of that curve, but you can't get it all. So there's certainly stuff in the real world that isn't there in the pion loops. But that's not a problem. The reason it's not a problem is that anything that happens at high energies is local when you look at low energies. And nucleon interactions in the nucleus take place at a binding energy of 10 MeV. Nucleon mass is in GeV, so it's low energy. So the high energy part of that looks like something local. The low energy part looks like something non-local, long distance. And so we can separate these two by that technique. That's effective field theory will do that. But it's even worse. Next slide, please. It's even worse. In QCD, the theory of pions is inherently nonlinear. And this has to do with chiral symmetry, which I won't even bother explaining. But let's just take it from me that there's a symmetry in QCD that forces a nonlinear Lagrangian. Lagrangian's written in terms of an exponential function, so an exponential of the pion field to all energies. It's going to turn into a non-renormalizable Lagrangian pretty soon. But it satisfies the symmetry. You can't get away from that. So the next slide, please. So the effect of Lagrangian that you get there is in general a very nonlinear Lagrangian, and in fact it has, in principle, has lots and lots of terms, an infinite number of terms. There's a term with two derivatives, a term with four derivatives, there's two terms with four derivatives, there's six derivatives, etc. All those terms satisfy the symmetries and could, in principle, produce pion interactions. However, at low energies, if you're low enough energies, only the leading energy terms dominate. But anyhow, we've now forced ourselves into a position where we have a nonlinear action, a non-renormalizable theory. We've ordered it by this energy expansion so that we can capture low energy effects. This theory has non-trivial backgrounds. It has soliton solutions. The amplitudes grow rapidly with energy. You can see it there. They diverge really badly. And naively, you violate unitarity and all sorts of bad things. Huh? Naively. In practice, it works out just fine. So, next one. So, the first thing you might want to do is how to deal with the non-renormalizability. And here's how it's done. It's really easy. You can renormalize the non-renormalizable. In this case, it's best to use the background field and dimensional regularization because they preserve the symmetries. So I expand quantum field, expand it around some fixed background. I expand the Lagrangian. I do the path integral over the quantum degrees of freedom. I isolate the one-loop divergences. The one-loop divergences look like something that shares the symmetry of the theory. So they look, and they're local because they come from the UV. So they share the symmetry of the Lagrangian. They look just like terms in the Lagrangian. And yes, you can absorb those divergences then into the renormalized parameters in this effect of Lagrangian. There's a power counting scheme, which I won't go through, but there it is. You can renormalize it into those parameters. However, that's not very predictive. What are the predictions? Well, let's look at this example, this nucleon potential. The high energy parts are divergent, but they're short range. So they go in this case, there's a contact interaction, a short range interaction between two nucleons, parameterized by this G sub S. All the high energy behavior goes into renormalizing G sub S. It's not a prediction of the theory. But you do the loop diagrams, you get out the long distance pieces, you get just those that are required by analyticity crossing, etc. So the long distance pieces are predictive, and fall out in a well-defined way from the theory. The high energy pieces where the effective field theory doesn't know anything about are parameterized by a few low energy constants, which you have to go out and measure. Okay, so there's the thing at work. Thanks. The next one. So my summary of this little exploration of effective field theory is that we were forced into doing loops, even in a non-renormalizable theory, by general principles, and here's the pathway. We identified the low energy degrees of freedom, pions. We got the general Lagrangian consistent with the symmetries. The effects were ordered in this energy expansion. The high energy parts were equivalent to local terms in the Lagrangian and not predictive, but the low energy parts were predictive and were well defined. Okay? Skip two this time. Thank you. So now, general relativity. Weinberg had long been talking about general relativity satisfying this paradigm, and in fact, it fits the paradigm like a glove. All those properties that you saw there were features that general relativity also shares. So it's a method of extracting low energy predictions from a theory that's non-renormalizable. Yet, the high energy predictions are not predictions. High energy effects are not made any predictions about. Okay, good. Why don't you stay here? This next one's short. Okay, the first step, we were supposed to identify the low energy degrees of freedom and their interactions. That's obvious, that's general relativity. We're taking gravity waves, just the classical theories, and general relativity. Next one. Sorry. Next one, stay up here again. So the next two steps are allow the general Lagrangian and order it by the energy, consistent with the symmetries, and order it with the energy expansion. Again, next. Oh, actually, it's working all of a sudden. All right. I have no idea what just happened, but so here's the general action. The general relativity shares a derivative of expansion because the curvature depends on two derivatives of the metric, and so you can order just like you could in QCD. There's a term with zero derivatives, two derivatives, four derivatives, etc. You can order. You write out all the terms consistent with the symmetry and order it. These higher terms, higher powers, are extremely tiny at low energies if those coefficients are of ordinary size. We'll see that. The parameters in this are not predictions of the effective theory. They have to be measured. The cosmological constant, you know, I'm going to neglect it because it's so small over ordinary energies, the energies we're talking about, that it's negligible. Newton's constant. And these parameters for the higher order terms are typically dimensionless parameters of order unity in chiral perturbation theory. There are 10 to the minus 3 dimensionless parameters. If they are anything like that, the predict their effects at low energies are extremely tiny. There's the quantization of the gravity waves is also by now well known. Started with Feynman and DeWitt. And again, the background field method is useful for preserving the symmetries. You expand around some background field, which is the thing to do if you're at low energies. You find the quantum degrees of freedom. There's slight complications of gauge fixing in ghosts, but those are things that were themselves understood in the 60s and 70s, so those aren't new stuff. The Feynman rules also were written out in the 60s and 70s. They're not new. The thing that's new is this effective field theory treatment of this. So instead of looking at the high energy parts, we're going to want to focus at the low energy parts. So let's just look temporarily at the high energy ones just to see how you get rid of them. So there is a power counting theorem that can come out that if you do one loop, you're going to end up producing terms of order four derivatives of the metric, et cetera. So if you see that, the one loop calculation was done by Tuft and Veltman first. Just like we pulled out the divergences in in chiral perturbation theory, you pull them out here, they look just like local terms in the Lagrangian because they come from the UV. They get renormalized into the parameters of the Lagrangian, and those parameters are non-predictive, but we go and measure them in principle. Okay. So that part also follows the paradigm. So now comes the more interesting part is, what is predictive and well-defined? Well, the low-energy stuff. How do you define low energy? Well, it's not the divergences. We've shown that they're local. They're not long distance. And they're not the parameters. The parameters we don't know. But there is low energy propagation of massless degrees of freedom. Things that go over long distances. And the easiest way to see these are non-analytic terms in an amplitude. You calculate an amplitude. If it's non-analytic, it can't be Taylor expanded about Q squared equals to zero, then it can't look like something in a Lagrangian. It's clearly something distinct, and it can only come from low energies. So long distance in coordinate space and non-analytic in momentum space get tied up pretty well. So my example, my favorite example since I was involved in it, is the quantum corrections to the Newtonian potential. How do you calculate that? Okay, so it's really just the scattering potential here. So technicality is just calculating above threshold, what's the scattering of two masses. At lowest order, it's given by just one graviton exchange, and you get the usual either momentum space potential or coordinate space potential out when you go to the non-relativistic limit. Nothing special there. Now, let's look at corrections to that. If you expand, the corrections are going to be of order G Newton because you're doing quantum gravity, quantum loops. You look at G over R corrections to make a dimensionless variable that's GM over R. That's the usual classical expansion parameter of the post-Newtonian approximation. If you want it to be quantum, you want an H-bar up there. So something linear in G, linear in H-bar, is a leading quantum correction. And to get a dimensionless parameter, you need 1 over R squared. So we, in fact, know what we're looking for. We're looking for G H-bar over R squared corrections to the usual potential. There's also, turns out, falls out a short-range piece, which is not surprising, just like the other calculation did. If you go into momentum space by just doing Fourier transforms, the square root of Q squared gives you the classical expansion parameter. The Q squared log Q squared correction gives you the quantum expansion parameter, you just Fourier transform back. And if you have an analytic piece, so these are both non-analytic, if you have analytic, Q squared over Q squared gives you a constant Fourier transform, the constant is the delta function, so the Q squared piece, analytic piece, is short range as advertised. And at this stage, before doing the calculation, you know the answer is parameter free and divergence free. Because divergences go like R squared, we saw that. R squared goes like Q to the fourth. So if I do 1 over Q squared, Q to the fourth, 1 over Q squared, I get a constant, and they go into constant pieces. Yeah, you know, you can do it out, it works the same way, but that's what happens. These guys are analytic, they give short range constant terms, delta function interactions. So the calculation basically is doing field theory. You do the field theory, and you find the non-analytic pieces that you're looking for, the logs and the square roots. You sum the diagrams, you Fourier transform, you get a well-defined answer. Here's the quantum correction, 41 over 10 pi gh bar over r squared. That's the leading quantum correction to the Newtonian potential. Just like our pion one, we had a leading correction. And then there's delta function pieces there too. All right. So, what should I say? Of these comments, I'll say it's unmeasurably small. That's actually good. We're doing perturbation theory. This is the best perturbation theory known because the perturbations are incredibly tiny. But I think most important is it's well behaved. There are two new results. Let me just advertise them and I won't spend much time on them. The quantum corrections have now been calculated in a variety of situations by Barry Holstein and my student Andreas Ross, and different spins, et cetera. But they turn out to be universal. It's really hard. It's of course the obvious thing to expect is they might be universal. The classical pieces, you have the equivalence principle to rely on. The quantum pieces, you don't. It's not as clear because this is long distance, long range propagation. But it turns out to be that way. There's also, I've worked on recently doing this same calculation just using this dispersive representation that I started with. So not using loops, but using on-shell states. And I'll just quickly go through that. Again, you have the potential given in terms of on-shell states only, so nothing off-shell. There's some expansion, and there's some correspondence to this potential. All you have to do is calculate gravitational Compton scattering, graviton in, graviton out. That gives you your amplitude. On shell, you multiply them together, you do the project out the low energy limit, and you get the same answer. It's actually an interestingly strong check on the calculation because, in fact, it was the details are extremely different, and both calculations are actually relatively tough. So, and the universality, that we have some arguments for that too. I think the easiest one is this dispersive representation. The Compton scattering is universal. If I can calculate the corrections from Compton scattering, I'll get the same results. Okay, good. So, there are a couple other calculations that have been done in the effective field theory type framework. One is graviton scattering. Graviton scattering. Again, there are terms that you can see, these non-analytic terms. It's a difficult calculation, but nevertheless it's doable. It's finite. There's an infrared singularity that's resolved in the usual way, so proving that it's infrared. But in a sense, it's beautiful because it's really a low-energy theorem of quantum gravity. So both these results are results that if you solve an ambitious theory of quantum gravity, valid at all scales, and you take the low-energy limit, you must get these if you limit to general relativity. So they're low-energy theorems in that sense, true for any high-energy completion of the theory. Hawking radiation also seems to be extractable from the low-energy theory, though I've not been involved in that, and I don't have too much extra to say. However, here comes the caveat. So we have a way of doing low-energy predictions. We can treat the quantum mechanics and general relativity together. What goes wrong? Well, within the context of the theory, you can see that it falls apart at high energies. The corrections to anything you calculate are going to grow like q squared times Newton's constant or q squared log q squared or things like that. And so they eventually overwhelm the leading effect, and this series expansion ceases to be meaningful. All orders become irrelevant. In addition, you can see that if you take these theories and try treating them perturbatively, that they're sick, but their sickness comes from energies or scales, curvatures, beyond the Planck scale. So, at the very least, the effective theory has to break down to Planck scale. It could break down earlier. If we discover that there's really 10 or 11 dimensions at 10 TeV, then it's broken down already at that scale because the theory changes. But at the latest, the effective theory doesn't continue beyond that. There's also the potential for some more interesting studies that haven't been done yet, but is there anything that goes wrong in the extreme infrared? I've actually been careful to try to keep us over ordinary energies, things like, you know, this distance to nanometers. But there are features of general relativity that point to perhaps infrared effects also. For example, the existence, the generic existence of singularities in space-times, and how do you propagate these fields past the singularity? Because at the, near the singularity, the effective theory breaks down. There are some thoughts about how to treat that, but there's also then some potentials for interesting new effects in the extreme infrared, but still the extremes. I try to think about matching this theory to a loop quantum gravity or a model that is supposed to limit to loop quantum gravity or limit to general relativity. Many of you have probably thought about these in more detail than me, but some of the obvious things provide a focus for what you need to look for, and therefore the things that could go wrong. You need to find the existence of low curvature backgrounds. We want to describe this world with a world that has extremely low curvature and is essentially a constant background because we want small fluctuations around this. We need to identify that it's 4D. We need to identify that the gravitons are spin 2 and that there aren't any other massless degrees of freedom other than, say, photons. You need to verify the coupling to that it's an interacting theory. Once you have that, and you then basically can use the Desser theorem to get you to general relativity. And then as long as you have causality, unitarity, and crossing, you're going to get the results of this effective field theory. So that's, I think, a good place to look. But this also suggests that gravity may be the best place to look for deviations from our theory. Now, in particle physics, we're used to looking for deviations to our present theory because we expect the standard model is going to break down. We, in practice, expect it's going to break down really soon, like next year, next decade in energy. Gravity, we expect to be more robust, yet it may actually be a better place to look. And the effective field theory reasoning for that statement comes from the Apoquist-Carazon theorem, which says that effects of high energies either get absorbed into the coupling constants of the theory, much like we've renormalized into those local coupling constants, or are suppressed by powers of the heavy scale, which in this case could be the Planck scale. Now, suppressed by powers of the Planck scale means it's difficult to see, but nevertheless there's an opportunity in gravity because all of gravity interactions are suppressed by the Planck scale. So the relative effect could be bigger in gravity than elsewhere. And there's then the hope that you could look for small violations of some of these fundamental principles like unitarity or causality that might be manifest at the same order in the Planck scale as usual gravitational interactions, or maybe not that far off, or maybe even general covariance could be an approximate low energy symmetry emergent from some other symmetry at high energies. And in fact, there is in QCD an example of this. There is pi naught to 2 photons in QCD reveals the number of colors of QCD. So it reveals the existence of the high energy degrees of freedom, the quarks of QCD, even when you haven't seen the quarks directly. If you had constructed the theory with just the chiral symmetry that you hypothesize at low energy, pi naught to 2 gammas would not take place in the massless limit. Yet in QCD, it does. And it's an effect of the chiral anomaly, but basically an effect of the high energy theory that shows itself in the low energy theory. And it's visible because all the effects of the effective field theory are suppressed. Okay, so here's my summary. I won't keep you from lunch longer. We do have a quantum theory of general relativity. It fits into the framework of effective field theories that have been developed over the past 20 years. The corrections that one calculates in the region where it's valid are extremely tiny, but they're well behaved. The ones I've shown you are all parameter-free predictions, There are in principle, could be other predictions that depend on the measurements of those low energy parameters, but the once you're measured, there's then predictions. Those things happen all the time in chiral perturbation theory also. If we're following this paradigm, we take a look at what happens to other effective theories when we go past the region of validity. Other effective field theories show this standard pattern of opening up new interactions, new degrees of freedom at high energies that we didn't necessarily see at low energies, like the quarks and gluons of QCD. And so there's clearly something, the effective field theory points to the need for something, whether it can be done within the framework of general relativity by itself, or whether you need new interactions and new particles, new things. That's an open question. But still, there's something needs to be done there, and the usual expectation is that there's new interactions and new particles. But that's not the same as those quotes that I started the talk with. It's not a conflict as much as it as a natural lack of knowledge about theories beyond the realm that we've explored them experimentally. And that's progress. So that's the goal of my talk. Thank you. Okay, so I'm being asked to repeat the question if it's asked from the front, so the people in the back can hear it.
Yeah, I embrace this attitude of effective field theory and try to sort of also bring in this statistical mechanics aspect of that. And the second point is the infrared direction is certainly producing a lot of interesting concepts and so on. My question is actually on the high energy part.
Okay. So he embraced the effective field theory and agreed on low energy being interesting, and he's asking a question about high energy. Yes?
Before you showed the third slide when you started talking about high energy that we really need a complete theory,
right.
I want to ask how you would do that. Now, you gave an example, for example, from the pi zero version 2 gamma,
right?
And it has some signature of the number of colors.
Right.
Can you draw some analogs? Gravity
of what kind of signature? Yeah, so the question was, in pinodes of 2 gammas, I said we had a signal that showed us the number of colors, showed us information about the high energy theory. And is there a comparable signal here? And I don't have it. Otherwise, that would be the focus of my talk. I'd love to have it. It's one of the things I'm here to start, you know, to see what everyone's thinking about it in order to think about more myself. But the ones that have been suggested are clearly things like violation of Lorentz invariance, violation of unitarity causality. The Lorentz invariance is a phenomenology which we'll hear more about later on. I don't think there's as much about the phenomenology of violation of causality, small violations of causality, or small violations of general covariance. And the equivalent of pi to 2 gammas would be a small violation of general covariance, a very specific effective interaction that violates general covariance, but only in a limited sector, which doesn't influence the symmetry of the rest of the sectors.
If I may just ask a question in response.
Yeah.
I mean, these are sort of negative things indicating the breakdown of things, which
you can't
expect.
Right.
And you can already see where it seems to be anything.
Right. Right.
And even the R squared type of terms,
right.
There was from Hungarian perspective, certainly also.
Right.
So everybody's sort of equal, right. And equally sort of ignorant on what next.
Right.
Yes. Yes. The bottom up.
Yeah. So bottom up, I think the question is, we're all ignorant about what the. About how it's going to get manifest. And until you have the completed theory, you don't know what those predictions are. So you need QCD to know what the chiral anomalies are. But if you were a physicist pre-QCD and looking around, you'd look for violations of some of the symmetries that you thought might be there. So that's why I think why violations of symmetries and violations of causality and analyticity might be good ways to look for it. Yes, I think looking for corrections like from the R squared pieces at low energies is probably futile because it's they're going to be extremely tiny. They should be expected to be extremely tiny. But violations of symmetry stand a better chance of sticking out. I mean, my favorite is actually looking at long distance light propagation through gravitational fields from long distances where general relativity predicts certain null theorems, like the redshift is independent of frequency. If that could be proven not to be true, that's a possible effect that could come from a violation of general covariance. It could in fact come from tidal effects from quantum effects. I think a nice example of something that could happen that we don't know the answer to yet.
Constants, C1, provide
yes.
Terms. From a top-down point of view, right. This underlying theory that I'm able to compute,
yes.
The idea is that I can predict them.
Yes.
Okay. And now the question is, for the application to be predictive, it has to be perturbative. So these constants have to be of order 1. The energy and the
those constants are dimensionless, and so.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So the question is can I put some constraint on the underlying theory in order to have order one?
Yeah.
Are there examples
that? Okay. Yeah. So if the theory comes from the Planck scale, one would expect those things to be computed to be of order one. Just naturally, I mean, that's the only, if there's only one scale in the theory, that's your scale. If the theory actually lives below the Planck scale, then you have a new scale, so there's a ratio of the Planck scale to other scales. Those coefficients can in fact be larger than one because they could be m Planck over m nu squared. That's a typical thing that could happen if you had a breakdown of the effective field theory at low energies, those would in fact be relatively large numbers.
So the answer is that I need two scales.
Yeah, so two scales would make those things, could make those things in principle become large. If you're in a one scale theory, they're generally of dimensionless parameters of order unity.
Another kind of example from ordinary theory, for instance, if I start with a normalized theory, with an high energy. I expect that order one constant.
Yes, you do. In fact, in QCD, they're 10 to the minus 3.
Okay, this is our.
That's order one.
Okay, and the question is do we expect this to happen even if we start with an order one manageable theory to integrate out high energy or not?
Yeah, I think it does. It's still the statement that I said before, is that it would be, if you're a one-scale theory, you'll probably get dimension numbers of order unity there. If you have a multi-scale theory, then you could, in fact, get a difference.
Okay,
thanks.
Yeah, you
previously
mentioned
the
quantum
radiation
effect.
Yes.
Yeah,
so the calculation that I... Oh, sure.
Gravitons only contribute to the radiation of the black hole, or can this effect be a gravity also shed some light on some of the statistical theory of the contributing to the black hole?
I don't know of anything that's in the effective field theory that's contributed to the black hole entropy issues. The only calculation I know that fits very naturally into effective field theory was the one by Cliff Burgess, where he's talking about non-gravitational radiation from a black hole, looking at a local Green's function far outside the black hole, so ordinary scales, but with that black hole being a distant way, and looking, using that Green's function calculated locally to get a thermal flux out, and showing that the calculation was independent of the high energy regulator that he used to define the Green's function. So it was a calculation that feels very natural in an effective field theory. It was a local calculation. It was independent of the high energy theory. It smells like effective field theory to me.
So did you
want
to elaborate?
Sorry?
Did you
want to
elaborate?
No, I think that's...
Also, the gravity community, people like Bill Andrew and Ted Jacobson, so also
yes.
show that radiation
yes.
robust with respect to changing the stress
right.
relations, such as it might come from very high
yes.
energy.
Yes, the comment was that there's other people in the gravity community that have shown that. I picked out this particular one because the others are calculations that don't feel as local as the one that Cliff Burgess did. He had a very nice calculation that was, you know, just defined over this little region here with a black hole over there, and I just look at local properties here.
I have a question. The comment was made that well, these infrared problems,
yep.
it is true that there is some signature which might have to do with weakening of the symmetries. That there is a correlation between kind of infrared problems associated with gravitons and the so-called EMS group, like null infinity, which is an enlargement of the quantum group.
Okay.
And to nice, in fact, an effective field theory point of view, this point was kind of looked at.
Okay.
And this is something that one also understands. The analog of that one understands the QED. So that.
Okay, well, if you think it's promising, I'll collect the references from you. Good.
The question was really important that, this effective field theory is, as you say, it's got us a lot of stuff. But recently, we also have learned a lot of new things from the observatories from asymptotic centers in particles,
yeah.
which is going in other directions.
Yes.
But I'm wondering if, in fact, one can learn something together. Lessons. Is there something that technically, you can learn from this asymptotic
certainty
and
mm-hmm.
instance of a non-dual
non-dual
fixed point,
only
there is not in it.
Yes, it's a fair question. Don Gaussian fixed point is in a region where we expect the effective field theory to fall apart. It's beyond the Planck scale. So, in the effective theory doesn't really say anything about that, except for the existence of the expected existence of not only R squared, R to the nth, but the whole power series. And so, the effective field theory is looking at that, worries that even if you've proven the fixed point to any fixed order in the derivative expansion, that it's going to be dangerous beyond that. So that's what it looks like to an effective field theorist size.
Just a small comment on a life I want to make. The calculations you refer to that show this rough sensitivity to the cutoff, I believe they all use the cutoff that's violated by the architect. So it's just being equipped with that. As in fact, if you cut off the preserved lines in there, then I think that would be a bad. Do you know what I mean?
I can't answer, I'm sorry. Okay, ask your original question.
You gave us an example, I understood that. You gave us an example where we got some kind of term in the Newtonian potential correction to the term. Which couldn't be described by a local field theory.
Right.
Low energy. So it has to be described by some non-local.
Well, no, it's described as a quantum correction in a local field theory.
Yes, maybe I didn't understand. You wanted to describe it just in terms of low energy.
So
there should be some sort of correction described by low energy.
No, in fact, that's... No, this is done with a local Lagrangian, and we keep the Lagrangian local. And all the non-locality comes from the propagation of light degrees of freedom. So the non-locality is a consequence of local Lagrangians plus massless degrees of freedom propagating over long distances. So you don't change your Lagrangian. You keep your Lagrangian local, but you're required to include loops. Okay, so if you were trying to integrate out the gravitons, you'd get a what I suspect would be a nonsensical theory of having a non-local interactions, but having your action be non-unitary. There'd be imaginary parts and cuts and all sorts of terrible stuff in your Lagrangian. This way of doing it, you have a local Lagrangian, and all your cuts come from loop diagrams with propagation of light degrees of freedom.
This would then mean that you couldn't, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it means you would not be able to reproduce an effective field theory description, something which I think might be the first real experimental evidence of quantum gravity, which
is a cosmological constant.
No, a cosmological constant. The cosmological constant produces that cosmological constant. It's a genuinely non-effective test, even in some sense of the class. So, would that mean an effect like that couldn't be?
I don't know if an effective cosmological constant fits in to the effective field theory. It, of course, requires you to. There's two ways to do it. Both, you can treat it by doing quantum field theory in de Sitter space, local quantum field theory in de Sitter space, or you can treat. In the physical case, you can treat the effect of cosmological constant as a perturbation itself, since it's extremely tiny. Well, the fluctuating, I mean, in the theory, it enters as a constant. The fluctuations are the gravitational degrees of freedom around that value. So you have, so it says, yeah, I would agree that if the cosmological constant is itself a function of space-time, then we have another field in the problem. Then you have another field. If those fluctuations are of long distances, you need to write out the Lagrangian for that new field. And, you know, a typical way to have a fluctuating cosmological constant is to have a scalar field in the theory. You have a Lagrangian for a scalar field that contributes to the cosmological constant, and its fluctuations are what describes that. So the only... I don't know. Maybe we should talk about that in some more detail, but there is certainly ways to do that.